everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. It is Friday. Let's get this week over with. I'm John Adirola. Nair's back in the studio.
Hello,
great to
be
have you here.
Thank you.
We always are very thankful to Bill Maher for making you available to us. That's the only time it's going to happen is when you're doing his show. So you're in town to do.
I am. I'm going to be on Real Time tonight.
Okay.
No. That's been announced. I'm going to be on Real Time tonight, and I'm going to do my part as a lady on the panel. So we'll see what happens.
Awesome. Any idea of any surprise guests or anything like that?
Is it going to be? No. But I do think it's going to be as Bill always has an interesting conversation. Maybe not as progressive as we might like, but like I said, I'll try to do my part.
I will restrain my commentary outside of that. Anyway, it's an enjoyable show. My girlfriend really likes it, and I enjoy it too. For what it's worth. Anyway, we got a big show, lots of stuff to talk about. Our first big block is going to be on the variety of new barbarous anti-abortion bills that are sweeping through the South. We're gonna be talking about that. Later on in the show, big payday loan restriction bill, AOC and Bernie Sanders pushing that. I wanna give a little bit of an update on media coverage of that massive UN report. It was just small news, you know, a million species might get wiped out. We're gonna see how much the media actually covered it. Later on, the US military's got a new missile and it's ridiculous. We're gonna show you. And two awesome guests are gonna be joining us. So Dave Leventhal is gonna be back on the show. We're gonna be doing our 10th edition, or I guess 10th installment of our series looking into the fundraising of the different Democratic primary contenders. And then later on, Ken Klippenstein of TYT Investigates has been doing some investigation into Border Patrol workers and what they really think about the people that they are coming across. And some shocking quotes he's gonna break down his reporting there. And also an update on one of the militias, how they are responding to his reporting, very interesting. So you're gonna wanna stick around for that. But first, the worst news ever. Across the South, these new draconian anti-abortion bills are being passed, and the possible consequences for both doctors and for women who dare to exercise their constitutional rights and have an abortion are ridiculous. And so I wanna get you up to speed on some of these. So the first, we're gonna be talking about Georgia. They have their so-called fetal heartbeat bill, which is misnamed for a number of different reasons, which we'll talk about. But the bills prohibit abortion once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. But reproductive rights advocates and doctors say the laws which prohibit abortion before many women know that they're pregnant amount to a near total ban on the procedure. And I'm just gonna go out there and say, that's the entire point. And we don't have to pretend that these people are just really concerned about fetal heartbeats. And that's what they're just finding any excuse to bring the line closer to, like, if you don't do it within 5 minutes of the guy popping, you're done. You can't have one. That's what they want, really.
Well, they want to return to what have been some of the horror stories in American history. Like this Roe v. Wade did not come about because people want to go around killing fetuses. It's because women were having miscarriages and having to be confronted by law enforcement in the middle of these horrible medical procedures that just happen naturally to women. I mean, like this legislation that's been written in Alabama and is being replicated around the country is being written by men who fundamentally do not understand how women's bodies work. Should we break some of that down?
Sure.
It might be a little gross for some of our listeners, but women get periods, and that's a sign.
Since when?
Right? It's a sign that you are releasing eggs, and you may be potentially fertile. And often you can have a fertilized egg that then just doesn't stick for whatever reason, because it's genetically not viable. That is called a miscarriage. You can miss a period, you can have a miscarriage without ever knowing that you're pregnant. That all can happen not only at 6 weeks, which is what this law says is now anything beyond 6 weeks is illegal, but at 7, 8, 10 weeks. You just don't know often what your body is doing. And this is men legislating what women's natural cycles are doing in the name of protecting children. Now, let's be honest, if you're gonna declare fetal heartbeat laws as the sign of that's when there is life and it's sacred, well then, are you gonna start mandating that people start paying child support at that point? Are you gonna start mandating that they take full care of the child? Are you gonna give it free public education? Like, where do you, when we define life at that point, when it's inside a woman's body, logically, it should require a whole bunch of other things that, frankly, Republicans right now are not willing to do.
Yeah, the implications are ridiculous. Megan Amram tweeted, if this is the case, then ultrasounds are child porn. Like, the entire thing is ridiculous from top to bottom. Let's get into a little bit more of some of the consequences, because Like, I think for right wingers who are fundamentally not really that interested in the science here, they want to ban it.
They don't want, I mean, this is not about science, let's be real.
Exactly.
If without science, you would have medical professionals and women involved talking about consulting or involved or even, frankly, you know, writing about it.
Exactly. And but they probably believe on some level, or certainly would have you believe, that what it's about is we can detect the heartbeat. It's a thing. It has a heartbeat. That's an objective line. They always want to pretend that they're acquiring some sort of objective line where it's okay to ban it.
But let's also be clear, when there's a heartbeat, you don't have arms, you don't have legs, and you barely can even have much of a brain.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's a fetus. This is what the body grows in mysterious ways.
Exactly. And I think importantly in this case, you don't even necessarily have a heart. So reproductive rights groups say the bill amounts to a ban on abortion at 6 weeks gestation. That's when a doctor can detect a quote flicker of cardiac motion on a transvaginal ultrasound. 6 weeks gestation is just shortly after most pregnant women miss their first period, meaning many women don't know they're pregnant, of course. But also, the cardiac activity detected at that time comes from tissue called the fetal pole, not from a heart, from a tiny little heart that they want you to imagine is there. There was some high-profile right-wing woman was spreading some image supposedly of a fetus at 6 weeks. And she had it obviously blown up so that it looks like it's baby sized.
Oh no, they had this being this viewed in like Times Square, right? Like big screens of like, oh look, the sanctity of life, without actually understanding any of the medical science behind it and how babies actually grow inside of a woman.
Yeah. And by the way, like I know that this is uncomfortable territory and everything. The fetus having toes or not is not a moral dividing line for when it's okay for a woman to exercise her constitutional rights. I know that they want to sort of like cloud the issue and make you think that that's an important stage. Oh, well, it's got a pinky now. Now I guess no, that's not how it works. That's not what Roe v. Wade says. We'll see going forward what it says since we now have a Donald Trump Supreme Court, but that's the state right now. And obviously, very importantly, they want you to focus on the implications for fetuses. I would like to focus on the implications for doctors and women undergoing these procedures. And here are some of the implications.
Yep.
A woman who seeks out an illegal abortion from a healthcare provider would be party to murder, subject to life in prison. And a woman who miscarries because of her own conduct, say while using drugs while pregnant, would be liable for second degree murder, punishable by 10 to 30 years imprisonment. Prosecutors may interrogate women who miscarry to determine whether they can be held responsible. If they find evidence of culpability, they may charge, detain, and try these women for the deaths of their fetuses. And it goes beyond even that. Obviously, the doctors, you're going to jail if you perform one of these. But let's see, if a Georgia resident plans to travel elsewhere to obtain an abortion, she may be charged with conspiracy to commit murder, punishable by 10 years imprisonment. An individual who helps a woman plan her trip to get an out-of-state abortion or transports her to the clinic may also be charged with conspiracy. And so, look, with all of these bills, considering the pop culture world we live in right now, it's like the first thing you think of is Handmaid's Tale. It's like a plot, it's a direct plot out of the second season of Handmaid's Tale.
Like, oh no, that's not actually what they're trying to do. That's hyperbole. But I'm kind of like, you're trying to charge women with murder for going out of state to do something that actually might be medically necessary. The people writing these laws would rather a woman give birth to a baby who doesn't have a brain and will die within a couple of days than have her go through that, have the family go through that, rather than doing a medically safe procedure that is best not just for women's bodies but for families all aboard.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's not even that this is how Gilead starts. This is where America was before. There was a reason why we had reproductive right movements and the ability for women to actually make decisions about their own bodies. Because frankly, you guys, you want us to make these decisions ourselves. You really don't want to be involved all up in there when it comes to any of the medical stuff. Trust me, we don't.
Yeah, the entire thing is just insanity. By the way, the thing where if you're planning to travel out of state to get it, they want to try you with
And that's also if it's rape or incest. They're not making any exceptions.
Yeah, no exception.
Here.
Obviously, the whole states' rights thing, that's been dead for a while, but I like to remind every once in a while you need to walk up and kick that dead horse because people still think that the right cares about that for whatever reason, has to do with the Civil War and all that. No, they don't care about other states. Anyway, the entire thing is incredibly frustrating.
It just sounds very difficult to be in Alabama right now.
Mm-hmm. Or Georgia, or a number of other places. Ohio had one of these was introduced under Trump. They're just becoming more and more common. These sorts of bills were considered not too long ago too extreme for anti-abortion groups. They didn't think that there would be any chance of it. But now they've got two more people on the Supreme Court. And so you know, they're ready. They want to try this thing.
And they're complementing this by also regulating doctors in a way where they literally can't get the licensing or insurance to even operate a clinic in anywhere in the vicinity, right? Like a clinic that actually gives you straight up advice about what medical care is, straight up advice about here's some birth control, right? Mm-hmm. Like the things that you want to do to prevent unwanted pregnancies are now also getting legislated out of existence. So it's just very difficult to maneuver this if you're in some of these states of how do you have a baby, how do you plan your family in a safe way and determine when you're ready to have a family? Because apparently they just want all these babies to be born and end up where, right? That's like, there's no plan on the back end to take care of any of these babies or the families.
And the last thing I want to say on this is obviously for the anti-abortion forces on the right, all of that, they take the Supreme Court incredibly seriously. And they have a far out stretching the future strategy around changing and then utilizing the new Supreme Court. And unfortunately, not everybody on our side takes it as seriously.
We were not nearly as organized as we should have been in paying attention to the judiciary. I mean, that is literally the deal that Mitch McConnell made with the devil, which was as long as they get the tax breaks that they want, as long as they get to try to overturn Obamacare and healthcare, and as long as they're able to get the judiciary you want, they'll let Trump do anything else. And this is part of the effort.
Yeah, and it was just a couple of years ago that back during the Trump election, when I kept saying, hey, maybe we should think a little bit about the Supreme Court and the implications of that. Some people did not want you to focus on that. Yeah. They wanted you to ignore that. I would say there's a good chance that the vast, vast majority, if not all of those people, were men. And it's convenient that now, when women's rights, inevitably, this is not some shock that, oh, they're challenging Roe v. Wade. We knew that was the goal. That's what they were going to do. It's not affecting those men who are claiming that. And I would say also they're far less likely to have even been talking about these stories recently. So
I just don't understand, you know, men who want to have babies that they're not willing to support, right? Mm. So like you, if you are a guy, you should be backing up the fact that women should have control over their own bodies. That really is ultimately to your own benefit.
I agree. And then of course there are gonna be challenges to all these bills, but that's the whole point that allows it to go to the Supreme Court. And then it's what, at best, a die roll that Roe v. Wade exists in 2020?
Mm-hmm. That's what's at stake.
Yeah, and so hey, maybe it'll be cool. Maybe it'll get revoked, and then we'll get to go through another multi-generation long effort to try to get women's rights re-enshrined in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That'll be fun. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Michael Bennett running for president, technically, and we're gonna be breaking down his fundraising and donors and all of that with Dave Leventhal, the Center for Public Integrity, after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic. Or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
I think we're well over 20 candidates now, 20 high profile candidates in the Democratic primary, and all of them are trying to generate enough money to both get on the debate stage and run a successful campaign. And so we have been committed to going through them one by one and delving into how exactly they're getting their money. And it's time for the 10th installment of our series. And joining us once again from the Center for Public Integrity, Dave Leventhal, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey John, good to be with you.
Good to have you here. And so today we're gonna be talking about US Senator Michael Bennett. He's one of the candidates that I think it's safe to say that our audience is probably gonna be the least familiar with. So right off the bat, what should people know about him and his background, his experience?
Well, first of all, he's a U.S. senator. So, you know, in any other presidential race, that would kind of be a big thing. Now we have multiple U.S. senators, of course, running, whether it's Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren, former senators, and Joe Biden. Of course, there's Bernie Sanders, people who wanted to be senators, and Beto O'Rourke. But Michael Bennett, not exactly a household name if you're outside of Colorado, the state that he's been a senator in for the better part of 10 years, and somebody who is very popular in the state. Somebody who has made a name for himself there, but right now is polling right around the 1% mark in this historically crowded race for the Democratic presidential nomination. So whether Michael Bennett is going to be able to elevate himself beyond just the second, third tier of candidates remains to be seen. He just got in this race. He's just putting together his operation, but it's going to be a very difficult path for him or any of the other candidates who don't have a bigger profile, don't have more money to draw from initially, and don't already have operations going in some of the early states like New Hampshire and Iowa, South Carolina, Nevada, where the proving ground really is going to become 9 months from now when votes start taking place, John.
Yeah, I don't envy him or many of the others the task of trying to push into, I would say, even the second or third tier. But you know, he's going to give it a go. And I think that with more and more candidates, I guess the risk of getting involved yourself is less and less. I'll probably declare next week. What's the difference? I might
we should
as well.
Be a ticket.
Let's do it.
Let's
you know what? Let's declare president, VP. We'll figure out one way or the other.
Sure.
And I think we can do this thing. So for Michael Bennett, I was actually surprised. I was talking with your colleague Sarah Kleiner yesterday about Joe Biden. I had thought that he was more independently wealthy than he was, which is helpful in a candidacy like this. For Michael Bennett, what about personal wealth? You know, past money that he's raised and hasn't used yet. What can he draw on going into this primary?
So by U.S. Senate standards, he's pretty middle of the pack. He's almost at the median. And so he's not hurting for cash. Okay, so you can measure his wealth probably in the high six, low seven figure range. But he's not the kind of candidate where he can come into a race and say, hey, I'm going to self-fund. I'm going to dump in $10 million of my own money. He's not somebody like a, you know, Ross Perot 25 years ago, or for that matter, a Donald Trump more recently. He's not going to be able to do that. Now, he does have one thing that is interesting. In U.S. Senate candidates and U.S. House candidates, they have the ability to transfer money from their House or their Senate campaign accounts to a presidential campaign account. And Michael Bennett has that ability too. He's got about $1.5 million left over from his previous Senate run. So by virtue of that, if he wanted to, he can shift that cash over into his presidential fund. And hey, that's some good kickoff money. He's going to have to raise a lot more in order to be competitive, but at least that gives you a good start and it at least paves the way for you to run an operation over what's going to be a very, very long period of time. I mean, again, it's 9 months until the first vote, and these candidates are going to have to actually run their campaigns in between now and then. That's a long interim period, to say the least.
Dave, talk to us a little bit about Colorado as a state, right? Not very long ago, it was red. Obama made it purple, and now we do consider it a blue state. What does that mean for the policies coming out of there and some of the money that's coming out of Colorado?
Sure. In Colorado, a very interesting state. It was a state that I covered fairly closely during the 2004 and 2008 presidential campaigns when I was with the Dallas Morning News, and got to know the people there fairly well. And it's definitely a state that has a very strong business community, but at the same time is very progressive, very liberal in certain regards, not the least of which is being at the vanguard of issues like medical marijuana and then recreational marijuana. So as a result of that, Michael Bennett, being a Democrat, is somebody who is very much in line with sort of the leanings of the population as it is right now. But that being said, there are still plenty of Democrats there who may not be to the left of the left. They may be more centrist. And Michael Bennett, I think you can fairly say, is going to not be on the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party right now. He's somebody who definitely has ties to the business community. He's received a lot of money from various business interests and people who have ties to business during his Senate career. So similar to Joe Biden, he's not somebody who is definitely going to be in the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing of the Democratic Party either at this point.
Colorado itself as a state also has a lot of like meat packers and cattle ranchers that he has to represent, and also big oil interests there given their oil shale and fracking interests. So how do you see that Michael Bennett navigating that going forward, particularly when it comes to his donor base?
Not something that he's necessarily going to have to worry too much about during a Democratic primary. If you're a deep red Republican and you don't like Michael Bennett, you're not going to have to worry about Michael Bennett until he becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party, were that ever to happen. So at least from that standpoint, he doesn't have a whole lot to worry about. But it kind of speaks to who he is as a senator. He's not somebody who has been a far left flamethrower. He's somebody who definitely, in representing his constituents, is going to be a more moderate Democrat, perhaps a more centrist Democrat, if you will, than some of the other folks who are in the Democratic Party right now, without question.
And it also looks like, based on your write-up, which is available at the Center for Public Integrity, people should definitely go check that out and find out a bunch more facts about his past and where he's been getting money from, the numbers and all of that. It looks like he's going to have to do a lot more work in generating individual donations if he wants to qualify for the debate stage. And that's going to be more and more of a challenge as more and more of these candidates come out. Dave, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate the work you guys do.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, AOC and Bernie Sanders have a new bill. We'll be giving you the details after this. Earlier this week, Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took on the banks and the payday loan industry with a big new bill. Their plan, which was unveiled yesterday, caps credit card interest rates at 15%. The measure aims to cut current rates significantly. The national average annual percentage rate hit 17.73% this month, while the median was 21.36%. So look, that obviously sounds high, but that's not the biggest issue that they're dealing with here. Payday loans carry annual percentage rates as high as 667%. And I think that they make it close to the mark of the beast, just so you know how you're being screwed there. So obviously insane. And if this bill were to be made into law, they effectively, that industry would go away, which is a major shame. Now they have a replacement for it. The lobbying groups behind these, both the banks and the payday loan lenders would say that competitiveness would go away. There wouldn't be options, except that there would be options because they would be setting up banking through post offices, which I hadn't actually known was a major thing not that long ago. Between 1911 and 1967, there was a postal banking system, and as many as 4 million Americans used that exclusively at that time. So that would come back. Why are they doing this? Not just because the interest rates are horrendous, but also because outstanding consumer debt topped $4 trillion for the first time in February. Now, I've already read responses to this from representatives of the major banking lobbying groups and all of that, saying that the American people will never stand for this. That may be, but I've also seen that nearly 90% of Americans support a cap on interest rates that financial institutions can charge on credit cards. So that seems like a battle that it won't be super hard to win in terms of public opinion. Although in the Senate, that's a different question, I guess.
Right, and that's the thing. It also goes to the fact that not many people who are outside of the financial services sector really understand the details of what they're signing up for with a bank. And it's important in the Obama administration, for example, the Treasury Department mandated that your bank statement, your credit card statement, actually tell you if you only paid the minimum. Mm-hmm. How long it would take you to actually pay off your credit card debt versus what you should be paying to pay. It's like something like 20, 30 years. So you find people, young people in college who show up, they're like, oh great, free money. And it starts the cycle immediately of trapping people in debt for not just their lives, but for the next generation as well. Also, many people are unbanked. They either don't have the proper documentation, aren't able to bank. And that is what this industry is really preying on, is the challenges people are facing structurally at the jump. And then also taking advantage of the fact that we don't have like financial literacy in college, in high school, or mandated as part of our public education training the way we should, and they take advantage of it.
Yeah. And in terms of precedent, credit unions already have a cap on the interest that they can charge. It was 15% for a long time. Now it's 18%. And previously, there had been a cap on, in general, on these sorts of loans, and then that fell apart thanks to some state efforts.
And I love hearing people who are like, oh, well, then if you don't have the money, you shouldn't be borrowing it. Well, congratulations. This is actually literally how people afford homes, because no one has a couple $100,000 sitting around, not for real. Yeah. And so we've designed a system that allows people to borrow, and banks can make a little bit of money. I'm not saying we should be handing out homes for free, but it's gotten to the point where it's predatory lending, and we've seen that it led to the collapse of banks in 2008.
Yeah.
Because again, they take advantage of people not understanding how the system works, and maybe the system should be more transparent then.
Yeah, and what a ridiculous point to make. If you don't have the money, you shouldn't be borrowing. If you did have the money, you wouldn't be borrowing. What does it even mean? I guess the industry would go away either way then.
It's the whole mythology of like, oh, you should be raising yourself up by your bootstraps and not recognizing that pretty much most of the things we have in society require some kind of give and take of debt.
Yeah, and by the way, Spareme, the companies, those credit card companies that are charging you 18, 20, 22%, they're borrowing money from the government at 2.5%. So they understand how a low interest rate can be positive.
Oh,
we just haven't gotten that.
And let's not forget that the magic of compound interest that they take advantage of also. Again, all these mathematical financial tools that you end up paying more on your mortgage. You pay the front end of your mortgage. You're paying the debt to the bank first before you're ever actually paying the money to own your house.
Exactly. And look, you're going to be hearing a lot more about this, but I just want to close with one tweet that AOC put out about this, saying there is no reason a person should pay more than 15% interest in the United States. It's common sense that we had these sorts of laws until the 70s. Max interest rates are record high for people with excellent credit too, which is a really interesting point that I think undercuts a lot of what the argument from the banks would be about why the interest rates need to be as high as they are. You would not have them going up for people with perfect credit scores if that was the case. But she ends with, it's a debt trap for working people and it has to end. And great job from her for taking the lead on this, Bernie Sanders for getting on it as well. Another great, bold proposal, rethinking things that our country has just taken for granted for longer than I have been alive. And it's great to see it being a part of not just American politics, but also this primary season. Okay, with that, why don't we jump to another topic? Yesterday in the show, we were talking about the major UN biodiversity report showing that a million plus species are at risk of going extinct, the majority of which could go extinct in the next few decades. That is major news in my mind, but not necessarily in reality, because a lot of major media outlets did not dedicate much time at all to that. So just in case you didn't see the initial reporting, you have an idea of how significant it is. A summary report released by the UN on May 6 finds that about 1 million plant and animal species are at risk of extinction due to expansive human development. The current extinction rate is, quote, at least tens to hundreds of times higher than it has averaged over the past 10 million years. That is due to a number of different ways that humanity is affecting the globe. Climate change is a part of it. Pollutions and toxins, overdevelopment, population growth, all of that is tied in with it. And it is significant. And this is not just murder, this is murder suicide. As we kill those species, we make it harder for us to live on this world as well. So significant. Now, how significant was it for the media? Well, on the broadcast networks, neither ABC's World News Tonight nor NBC Nightly News mentioned that assessment at all. Significant segments on those networks instead focused on a Russian airplane fire, former Trump attorney Michael Cohen reporting to prison, and the birth of a royal baby in Britain. CBS Evening News was the only broadcast nightly news program to air a segment on the biodiversity report. And overall, out of a total of 26 primetime news shows airing on the major broadcast and cable networks on May 6th, only three included coverage of the global assessment. Three out of 26. One of those, by the way, was Fox News. So that's great. You want to know what they did? They brought on a climate skeptic who laughed about it. And by the way, not bringing on the climate skeptic and him laughing at the report, okay, I'm not really surprised by that. But I think it was Brett Baer, I believe, who was the anchor, the straight news anchor, who introduced it as leftists freaking out over this report. So that was one of the three possible attempts that people had of being exposed to this information if they're watching TV that night.
Yeah, it just goes to the broader misunderstanding of actually how we all live and work together, and the fact that you do require science and require diversity, biodiversity to, you know, eat food, to grow new foods, to do any of the things that sustain our day-to-day life. We're very divorced from the reality of what it means to for farmers and what it means for our water and clean water and just the things that we take for granted.
Exactly. Yeah, this is all tied together. Like over here, you're seeing some bees. They're significant in ways that I'm familiar with, and far more ways that I'm not familiar with. It's important. And bees, by the way, it's great that you guys went to that bee roll. B-roll, because they're more threatened than a lot of other species. And I believe in the US, their populations are down by like 88% in the past few decades. Mm-hmm. This is all significant, it should be covered. And I am really depressed that this isn't even a climate change story necessarily. It's affected by it, but anything at this scale that's difficult to show one face to, generally the media doesn't care. And that is incredibly depressing. And we have tried over the past year of this show existing to focus on these sorts of stories. And I'm gonna continue to do that. I will go down with that ship. And that metaphor is apt because these videos don't get any views. We did a story about the UN biodiversity thing and it got like 1/50th the views that our thing about Meghan McCain freaking out on The View got. That's depressing. And look, you're watching this, so you're probably not one of the people that I'm targeting with this.
You should care about science.
You should care. And there is a reason that the media focus, like we got an issue in two parts. With the mainstream media, they take one big story that might be important legitimately, and then they talk about it for 6 hours straight. Every show is focused on whatever Michael Cohen said or whatever. And that's important, I'm not saying it's not important.
No, and I then think you what have, Michael Cohen said is really important.
Maybe not.
I mean, let's be honest. This is the 50% of the world's biodiversity, right? 50% of the species in the world are just disappearing.
Yeah.
That's
25% of all the plants.
We should care.
Yeah, and so that's the mainstream media. They focus on one story. And then you have the independent media, the online media, and that can be better. But I look at a lot of these channels and the vast majority of the videos, it's one person destroys another person, or one person looks like an idiot, or here's some drama with this person. And I get it, that stuff is very fun to talk about. That's why we do it sometimes here. It's enjoyable and it's profitable. People click on those videos. Mm-hmm. But I feel we're between a rock and a hard place.
All right, so we gotta figure out how we make bees sexy.
Exactly.
What's a sexy bee look like?
Exactly, I don't know, we can find a costume or something. I'll put it on, I'll do a segment as a bee, we'll see how it works. I don't know, honestly. I talk about climate change more than literally anyone else, and even I haven't found a sexy way to talk about it. But I'm working on it, people. Please stay tuned. Anyway, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Ken Klippenstein is gonna be joining us. He has uncovered some shocking details of what's going on the border. We'll be breaking it down after this. Joining us now, once again, investigative reporter for TYT Investigates, Ken Klippenstein. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you here. This is an exciting one. So you've got a new piece and you uncovered some of what some of the militias operating at the border have apparently been doing and also saying about the migrants that they're encountering at the border. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, I like to feel like I'm sort of a nerd to some of the horrors of this administration, but this one surprised even me. Found was that there was a police report filed by an individual in this border militia operating in New Mexico. He was informing on another member of the militia. They're called the United Constitutional Patriots. And he said that this other member, while they were monitoring migrants coming across, the other member, who at the time was holding an AR-15 rifle, said, "Why are we, you know, observing them and not just lining them up and shooting them?" And I'm going to read this so I get the quote exactly right. Look at my notes here. "We have to go back to Hitler days and put them all in a gas chamber," is what one of the other militiamen said. And let me stress, he had a gun at the time and, you know, they were watching actual people crossing the border.
And of course, we should remind people that it wasn't long ago that one of these sorts of militia groups, I don't believe it was the same one, but had been effectively kidnapping migrants by holding them against their will, something that they're not legally allowed to do. What else can you tell us about this particular militia group? How long has it been operating? Does it have a lot of people down there? Does this seem like it might be an aberration?
I believe it was the same group, actually.
Oh, was it?
Kidnapped these 200, yeah. And what's particularly scary about it is that these groups coordinate with law enforcement, not just at the local level, but the federal level. You know, we know for a fact that they have provided, you know, intelligence, eyes and ears to Customs and Border Patrol, different groups like ICE, and they're fine with that. They don't have any sort of problem with it. The reason this became, you know, a big national story is because it got to the level of this guy threatening violence in conjunction with the actual kidnapping of 200 some migrants, including women and children. They have no authority to do that. These are just random people. They haven't been deputized or have any sort of legal power to detain individuals like that. And that's really why it became an issue. And if you listen to the public statements that CBP provided generally, and also to me in my story, they said, you know, we don't condone kidnappings or, you know, threats of violence or whatever. But they also said, however, people, you know, should still send us tips. And they're kind of doing a, you know, winking at people that want to continue, I think, to engage in these sort of militia practices. And in my opinion, it's naive to think that you can have people just observing and reporting as they're holding guns, which is legal to do in New Mexico and, you know, probably Texas too and other states like that, and not have it devolve into these sort of dangerous, potentially violent situations. I mean, I imagine it's hard to keep them. I mean, if you listen to the rhetoric that they espouse, they think that they're being invaded. They think that they're protecting the country against these foreign invaders.
So, Ken, I think it's. What is it about these militia groups that has FBI and Customs and Border Patrol treating them differently than, say, armed gangs, right? Because we were supposed to be worried about gangs who are bringing migrants through and interacting with them, but now we're worried about militias instead.
Well, the idea is that they're just supposed to be observing and reporting, but sort of as I was explaining, I think that's naive when you have a lot of these groups basing their activities on this ideology that the U.S. is under invasion. Of course, they're going to regard them as, you know, enemies and maybe even combatants. So, but
the FBI doesn't really seem to be dealing with these militias as enemy combatants. What is it something about the makeup of the militia groups? Is it regional? What is it?
These groups have been operating for a number of years, and I think that CBP and law enforcement likes them because they give them tips about where, you know, migrants are moving that they may not be able to do, or that they, you know, might get bad press coverage for going and doing.
Well, John, what do you think? I think we should just call them gangs because gangs have informants as well that work with the FBI.
Yeah, it is interesting how that word militia has stuck.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they want it for constitutional reasons.
I wonder if there's some demographic issues there as well.
Exactly.
Very subtle.
And we're sort of talking about PR here. So you discovered in an update to the story that constitutional border patriots or whatever, you know, amalgam of good sound and word, the bald eagle America guys, they decided to change their name after this?
That's right. They said that they're, you know, restarting under a different name, and they've disavowed the individual who said those things. But if you look at the, you know, rhetoric coming from a lot of the other people, I mean, it's not as extreme, but they still regard these migrants as invaders. So I can't imagine that this was just one totally exceptional case.
And in the case of this one group, I believe that the FBI actually arrested one of the leaders of the organization, right? What was that about?
Yeah, so this was in relation to the kidnappings. Mm-hmm. Again, that's illegal, and they stupidly posted a video of it, sort of propaganda, saying, look at all the great work we're doing on the border. And when they kidnapped them, allegedly, they identified themselves as Border Patrol, which is impersonating a federal agent, a felony. And so that's why he was arrested and why they were investigated by the FBI, because they posted the video and everyone got upset about it. You know, it became viral in short order. Without that video, you know, one has to wonder if law enforcement would have done anything.
And I had one more question. So you said that this initially came about as a result of one of the members of the group informing on the other. Was this, the one who was informing, was he some sort of plant, or was he an otherwise member in good standing that just had some sort of personal beef, or was he genuinely concerned about what he was hearing?
It's unclear because it was clear at the time that he reported this stuff. The FBI had started investigating them, so he may have been trying to get out in front of something so that he might not be charged with conspiracy. Because if someone starts talking about stuff like this, and if there's a shooting, and they had been working together at the time at the border, he might be trying to cover himself so that he's like, oh, you know, I did, you know, I spoke to you guys about him. I wasn't working with him. But no, he wasn't. As far as I know, he wasn't a confidential informant or anything. And I don't think that they would have released the records to me under the Freedom of Information Act if he was one.
Okay. Well, we very much appreciate your work. The full write-up is available at TYT.com. People should go take a look at that. Ken, pleasure as always.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, the U.S. military's new weapon, it's a doozy. We'll show it to you after this. Cruise missiles and bombs are so 90s. We've got far cooler stuff for the military to fling at our enemies now. I want to take a look at this tweet that had some interesting information in it. So Nick Waters had said, he investigates these sort of things. Says, I remember puzzling over these cuts. You can see images of a vehicle there. The roof is caved in, but there's also branching off in four directions, interesting cuts in the actual metal. And there was one of the leaders of Al-Qaeda at that point had been killed in this strike. And he says, turns out it was a Hellfire missile with swords attached to it, which sounds
pretty cool.
Ridiculous, but now we know that it is in fact true. Say hello to the R9X. If you take a look at this, you're gonna see it's a missile, almost the size of a man, and blades spring out of it like Wolverine in missile form. And they say that there's no explosive, by the way, so it just hits with obviously blunt force, its weight and all that, but also blades, with the idea being that it will be less likely to damage people other than the target that you're planning to attack.
And I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on blades. It's like ninja swords, because I was saying like this is what you tinker with or imagine that you're tinkering with after watching a great movie and like make your own missile. But I'm like, no, this is actually really how the US government is spending money.
Exactly. I mean, I have no idea how much money, probably a lot because it's military technology and everything is so ridiculously overinflated. I hope that it's less expensive than a traditional missile that has actual explosives and things like that. But it also has to be incredibly accurate since you're trying to cut someone with a knife from hundreds of miles away. Look, it apparently worked in this case. All else being equal, if they're at least thinking about civilian casualties, I guess that's a good thing. But many people will look at this and some will just be like, oorah. Some will be like, oh, good, a development. I would go one step further and say, if we have missiles that we think, let me go a little bit deeper to give you an idea of why I'm so concerned. So we have, I'm gonna jump ahead. One former US official said the weapon addressed a longstanding right seat, left seat problem, suggesting it is theoretically possible to kill someone sitting in the passenger seat of a moving car, but not the driver. Okay, I looked at that car. I would not have wanted to be in the driver's seat then. But my bigger point is, if we have missiles that we think we can deploy to kill the driver of a bus, but not the passenger, we might be a little bit more inclined to start using it. And that's not necessarily a good thing.
And that's the thing, right? Like if you look at the federal budget, we spend less than 1% on development and diplomacy, which are the things that actually help prevent us needing to go to war to begin with.
Exactly. I would like to avoid having to put cleavers and billy clubs and all sorts of things on cruise missiles. Let's avoid dropping any sort of ordnance, whether it has blades or not. And the larger issue too is that, so this gets out. I think that this somehow generally is probably gonna be a win for the military. It's gonna look like they're taking this seriously, but it's not like we stopped the shipments of cluster munitions and things like that to the Saudi Arabian government. That's still going on. Right. We're still helping them with the technology, the training, the parts of all of those things. So
a big part of how the US makes money on its investment in military technology isn't because we get to have cool stuff. We sell it to other countries. Yeah. And once we sell it to other countries, we don't control how they use it. So, right, you mentioned the Saudis and Yemen. Israeli technology, how that's being used. So this is the downside of the really cool military weapons porn.
Yeah, and I wonder, so I mean we've had a conversation recently thanks to efforts in the House and the Senate, Ro Khanna and Bernie and others as well, including one or two Republicans, to get us out of the Yemen conflict, which seems like perhaps the initial steps towards the legislature taking a little bit more control over the military conflicts we're in. With Trump, I mean, not only is he all in on selling weapons, no holds barred, whoever wants them, we want to make as much money as possible, but super aggressive towards Venezuela, even more aggressive towards Iran. That's not getting talked about as much, but what's being done right now is
absolutely insane. But really friendly with North Korea.
Exactly, as they're doing more weapons testing. So you obviously have a lot of experience in this area. What do you make of this really, like, it's like a split personality where it's like, hey, we're taking it a little bit more seriously with these missiles and everything, but we also might start multi-front, multiple wars.
And that's the danger when you have people like Trump in power, and it really does tend to be the civilians who get really excited about what you can do with weapons and war, and then the generals who say, hey, step back. We actually have to navigate people and our troops, and you've had generals testify before Congress, even in this administration, saying we don't actually need more money for bullets. What we need more money for is the diplomacy and the development and humanitarian work that stops us from having to go to war to begin with. If you don't fund that side of the house, then yes, you will end up having to buy us more bullets in the end. Yeah. And so it's part of a bigger picture of how people who are actually professionals at this, what they believe versus those who are amateurs and what they get excited about.
Super fast, just because I'm curious, I don't know that you, maybe you still have the context to know. I had heard early on under Rex Tillerson that the halls of the State Department were effectively like ghost towns.
We have almost no ambassadors overseas.
It hasn't recovered.
Nope, not really. And actually, we hadn't had a Secretary of Defense even overseeing any of this for almost a year. Trump just nominated the guy who was in that acting position just this week. Yeah. Again, only because it was under pressure of like, you've got nobody here. All you have is Ivanka apparently running your like, you know, work. People need to make more money, but not really, because they don't want a minimum wage. They want to work for every cent. Yeah. And then you've got Jared on the other end running Middle East diplomacy. Like, you actually don't have any experts or professionals there right now.
Okay, so we're going to leave the week on that scary note. Nahir Haq, always great to have you here.
Thank you.
You can see her tonight on Real Time with Bill Maher. So always glad to have you here.
You.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
Thank you everybody for watching throughout the week. We're going to be back next week. Huge guests, lots to talk about. You're not going to want to miss it. And we'll see you on Monday. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.